Welcome to the next installment of Talmud Makot. Some of you might have taken a different chapter with a different teacher in our previous semester. We are doing the first chapter of Masechet Makot together. And this chapter's focus is on a category of witnesses called Edim Zomimim. To be Zomim is to be a planner. Okay, but in this case, it's not a kind of neutral planning, like you're planning a trip. It is a sinister planning where you are basically fabricating evidence. Okay, you are false witnesses. You're coming to the court, you're fabricating evidence, and you're doing that in the hopes of getting an innocent person to be punished. Okay, that punishment could be mild, like you say, hey, I saw this person steal $5 from someone else, and then the penalty for that person will be $10, not a lot of money, okay? Or all the way up to, I'm going to lie about somebody's personal status, okay? And then they're not going to be able to marry the person they want to marry. Or I'm going to lie about a person committing a really violent crime, okay? Or a murder, and my false testimony, were it to have been accepted, okay, would have led to somebody losing their life. Okay, so the Edim Zomimim category kind of covers the entire span of anything that I could possibly lie about in court, from lying about something minor to lying about something much more significant, or perhaps the most significant, which would be the taking of a life. The Mishnah is structured in a way that makes sense for the Mishnah. I'll tell you what I mean by that in a second. Not necessarily a way that makes sense for you as a learner coming to this material for the first time, okay? The Mishnah and the Talmud have a lot of different loyalties, okay, that are not just loyalties to what is the clearest way for me to lay out this information, what is the most orderly way for me to lay out this information, okay? The Mishnah sometimes, if you pay close attention, you'll see that often in certain chapters of Mishnah, the shortest Mishnayot will be first, and then it will get longer and longer and longer. Okay, that is an aesthetic commitment. That is a mnemonic commitment, right? It's easier to memorize when you know that they're getting longer and longer and longer. But that doesn't necessarily make for the most user-friendly, student-friendly way of laying out information. Okay, and the Talmud also, the Talmud likes to do things in threes. The Talmud likes to, you know, juxtapose interesting conversations to each other. For mnemonic purposes, it likes to have long lists of teachings by the same person. Okay, that's not always going to help you get to the information that you are looking for in the most orderly way. I'm saying all this both because it's interesting and important information about the Talmud, and also so that you should be prepared. We are not going in the order of this chapter at all. The order of this chapter is not designed for your comprehension. It's designed for aesthetics. It has other commitments. Okay, so you are going to be like, wait a minute, we're bonking all around. I thought we would start with page 2 and we're starting with page 5. It's not your imagination. It is my gift to you. Okay, then I have reordered the Talmud in a way that is student and material centric and less concerned with aesthetics and numbers and mnemonics. Okay, so the Talmud is a beautifully well-organized book, but we are going to do things out of order because we have our own priorities as we're learning. We're going to look at the three different places in the Torah where false witnesses come up, okay? The first, I hope, will be somewhat familiar. You may have heard of these Ten Commandments. They're pretty hot, okay? So one of the Ten Commandments is, Lo ta'ana bereacha eid shaker, do not bear false witness against your fellow. Very straightforward, very short. Do not lie in court against somebody else. Okay. Later in Shmot and Mishpatim, it becomes a little bit more complicated, right? The language is a little bit more expansive. Lo tisa shemashav, right? Which in the English, it's translated as, you shall not spread a false report. Okay. But I think that really what they're talking about here is, Don't go into court and testify about something as if you've seen it when actually it's hearsay. Okay? The rabbis love eyewitness testimony and they do not accept hearsay, so much so that the Sanhedrin, the rule is that you're not allowed to accept translated testimony, right? Because you don't know. Basically, what you're hearing from the translator is hearsay, right? The translator heard it from the witness, and then you are hearing it from the translator. You're not hearing it directly from the witness. And that's where this, I'm not going to say it's not true, but I'm also not going to say it's been historically verified. Idea comes from that if you're going to be a member of the Sanhedrin, the member of the highest court, you definitely know all languages that could possibly be spoken, okay? Because that's the only way it works to say you can never use a translator is, oh, well, that's fine. Because in any court that you go to, for sure, the person who you are testifying in front of will know Portuguese, so we don't need a translator. Okay, but anyway, back into the text of the Psukim. Lo tisa shem hashav. Don't report a false report, okay? Don't bring a false report. Al tashet yadcha im rasha lihiyot eid chamas. Don't add your hand to someone who is wicked to be a, the English translation here is malicious witness. Chamas is often a term that's used for getting money wrongly and in a violent way, okay? And so essentially you might think, oh, this is much more gentle, right, a much more classy of a way to steal from someone. I'll just testify against them in court. Okay, no, right, we're still calling you an aid Hamas. We're calling you an agent of violence. When you join with someone to be a false witness, okay, and you have to join with someone because according to the rules of rabbinic jurisprudence, there's really very rarely circumstances where only one witness is believed. The general understanding is testimony is constructed by two witnesses who have seen the same thing at the same time. Okay. And then the next psukim are really then kind of addressed to the members of the court, the judges. Lo tiye acharei rabim l'rabot, v'lo tane al riv lintot acharei rabim l'hatot. You shall not follow a majority in wrongdoing. When you bear witness in a lawsuit, you shall not side with the majority so as to pervert justice, nor shall you be partial to the poor in a lawsuit. Okay, and essentially now we're taking the focus, right, away from the witnesses and saying, hey, also judges, you have to be vigilant, okay, and you have to be careful that you're always following the truth, even if you think that you could do something more moral, okay, by deviating from the truth. No. Right? Dalo te darbirivo, you shall not be partial to the poor. You have to do only according to what the witnesses are telling you, right? Whatever they provide for you, whatever you think is accurate, which might not be the same as what you feel is right. Okay. And these are the verses that specifically use the language of zomein, of planning, intending to do something that doesn't necessarily come to fruition. Okay, we are starting. Lo yakum eid achad ba'ish. A single witness shall not suffice to convict a person of any crime or wrongdoing in connection with any offense that may be committed. Only on the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a charge be sustained. Okay, and it seems like the reason why we only believe two witnesses is it's much harder to lie. Right? If I need to bring somebody else into my lie, then it's much, much more difficult for me to actually come forward with testimony that's not accurate. But what happens? Ki yakum eid chamas ba'ish. What if a malicious person, a malicious witness does come forward to accuse someone of wrongdoing? La'anot bo sara. This phrase is very difficult to understand. Okay, the NRSV translation, which is the one that I prefer and I always put on the source sheets, says to accuse someone of wrongdoing, but I think it could also be lanot bo sara, to talk about that person in a way that is not accurate. Okay, lasor is to like deviate. Okay, so either I'm testifying about someone that they have done something devious, or my testimony itself is a form of deviousness. I'm supposed to report exactly what I saw and only what I saw. La'anot bo sara is to report something that is deviating from what I saw. Okay. Then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. And the judges shall make a thorough inquiry. Vidarshu hashoftim heitev. And then if it turns out, if the witness is a false witness, having testified falsely against another, eid sheker ha'eid, sheker ana be'achiv. Okay, then, and this is basically what our whole chapter is about. Va'asitem lo ka'asher zamam la'asot la'achiv. You, judges, have to do to the false witness just as the false witness had meant to do to the other. Okay, so if through my testimony, I would have caused Beryl to have to pay $20, if it turns out that I was lying, I'm the one that has to pay $20. Okay, if through testifying about Beryl, Beryl would have been put to death, then I also am going to be put to death. Okay, this is extremely important to remember, okay, because one of the sticky things about Eid Zomeim, and it's going to come up later, is, wait a minute, through the mechanism of Eid Zomeim, a person can be put to death for attempted murder. Okay, I didn't actually put that guy to death. And nevertheless, ka'asher zamam la'asot la'achiv, I get penalized for what I intended to do, what I planned to do, and not necessarily what I succeeded in doing. Okay, uvi'arta haram mikir becha, and you are going to purge, you're going to burn the evil from your midst. When the Torah says uvi'arta haram mikir becha, or a similar phrase, you got to get rid of the evil, okay, it is often in scenarios where you're like, but is it that bad? The punishment seems like a little extreme. And so when the punishment seems a little extreme, sometimes the Torah will like back itself up and say, I'm serious about this. Okay. This is something that needs to be taken care of. Do not take this lightly. Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha. You need to get rid of this pernicious influence. You got to go after it real hard. Okay? Because Hanisharim Ishmu Viro, the rest, right? The people who are seeing, reading the papers, they're going to hear and be afraid. And a crime such as this shall never again be committed among you. It's true, it does seem like a really extreme response. But you know what? We're doing this extreme response, hopefully, once or a vanishing number of times so that we don't run into a situation where people are always popping up in court and saying things that are not true and trying to get their fellow person to be punished for something that they didn't do. Okay? Verse 21, V'lo tachos einecha. You should show no pity. Life for a life, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, hand for a hand, foot for a foot. Okay? This language might be used, may be familiar to you from where we usually talk about an eye for an eye, which is if I poke out somebody's eye, then my own eye is going to be poked out, either literally or financially, okay? But here, it's basically saying a life for what would have been a life, right? An eye for what would have been an eye, and the Torah is being very emphatic. We're serious about this, okay? Getting up there and testifying falsely is not a game. And because people might think of it as being not as bad as going over myself and poking out somebody's eye, right? The Torah makes sure to emphasize it is a very, very bad thing to be an Eid Zomeim, even if you're caught before any actual harm could happen. And we're going to take care of you. We're going to get rid of this evil in our midst in the most like severe way. Okay. I want to say one thing about the Rambam, then I'm going to open for any clarifying questions, then we're going to dip back into some of the rabbinic material. If you look at the verses, you will see there are basically two terms that are used. Eid Shaker, as in Lo Ta Nebereacha, Eid Shaker, and Eid Hamas, okay? And also in Dvarim, we have this language of zamam, although the noun form of a deem zomimim does not actually appear. Okay, that's a special rabbinic construction. Okay, but essentially we have the Rambam says straight out, with no ambiguity, an eid zomim is an eid sheker. There's actually no difference between the conspiring witness and any person who testifies falsely. Devarim, right, the verses that we saw at the end, are just an expansion of what had been prohibited in the two passages that we saw in Shmot. Mi she'id b'sheker, somebody who testified falsely, v'noda be'edim she'id b'sheker, and it became known through witnesses that he testified falsely. This is the person who is an eitz omeim, okay? And it's a mitzvah, la'asot lo k'mo she'ratza la'asot be'eduto. You have to do to him as he sought to do through his testimony. Okay, the Rambam isn't splitting hairs between this one's an eid sheker, this is an eid chamas, this is an eid zomim. Other people do, okay, try to figure that out, try to fix that. But the Rambam essentially says the paradigm for a false witness is what's being described for us in Dvarim Yotet, is the paradigm of the eid zomim. I want to say one like little piece of background legal information that's going to help you before I take any clarifying questions from these psukim. You're going to be asking yourself, okay, but what happens if I'm not an eid zomeim, but I am an eid sheker, right? What if I said something wrong? The court knows is wrong, but they can't prove that I am, like, through all the technicalities of an eid zomeim. The technicalities of which we are going to be going through over the next couple of weeks. So essentially, that term, the term that is applied to those people, is mukhash, which is essentially contradicted. Okay? That testimony is thrown out. Okay? It is considered to be invalid. But as far as we know, there's no specific penalty assigned to those witnesses. Okay. This is something that is very surprising. Okay. And not sort of uniformly accepted. But essentially, there's the eid zomeim, there's the conspiring witness who has attempted to do something, and we have figured out that they are eid zomeim. Okay. And then there's other witnesses, a single witness gets up. Or two witnesses come up and they have different narratives. Okay, in those scenarios where you can't be officially classified as an eid zomeim, but like something was off with your testimony, we throw out the testimony, but you yourself do not suffer any penalty. Okay, what we are going to be doing today, out of order, because the Mishnah is completely out of order, is we are going to get to basically, the core definition of what makes someone an eid zomeim as opposed to any other lying witness. But I'm just giving you this background because that question is going to be the first question that's going to pop into your head when we go through the Mishnah. Okay, so now we're at our first Mishnah. We are starting with Mishnah 4. Okay. Ein ha'idim na'asim zomimin. Witnesses are not considered to be perjurers, right? Essentially, these conspiring witnesses, ad sheyazimu et atzman, until they themselves are incriminated. Okay, the Mishnah is going to unpack this for you. I'm going to say it for you outside quickly, and then it's going to be reiterated in the Mishnah. Essentially, there's two ways that I can say that a person is lying about their testimony. One way is I come and I say, but those facts are not accurate. Okay. This person said the victim is wearing a red shirt. I know that guy is allergic to red shirts, so it's impossible that the victim was wearing a red shirt. Okay. That is another set of witnesses coming in and arguing about the facts of the case. The other way that I might be able to determine that somebody is a false witness, they're not telling the truth, is they couldn't possibly have seen what they said they saw. Okay, so I'm not actually talking about the content of their testimony. The content of their testimony might even be accurate, But I know that they couldn't possibly have been eyewitnesses because they were somewhere else. Okay? So when we say ad sheyazimu et atzman, until they themselves are incriminated, we're talking about this latter form of contradiction. The first witnesses say, we saw Bob kill Bobina on Monday, in Central Park. And then two other witnesses say, you couldn't possibly have been in Central Park on Monday to see Bob kill Bobina because you were with us in, I don't know, Idaho. And it's impossible for you to have seen what you said that you saw. Okay? And so now the mission is going to unpack that. Kate said, what does this mean? Amru, if they said, Mi'idin anu bi'ish ploni sha'ragat ha'nefesh, we testify that so-and-so, right, killed someone. And then the others, that is the second set of witnesses, the contradicting witnesses say, how could you testify to that? As that murdered person, okay, the neharag, the victim, or the horeg, the murderer, were with us on that day at such and such a place. Then the witnesses are not considered to be perjurers. Okay, I'm just going to unpack this a little bit because there's a lot of pronouns. Okay. The first set of witnesses, set A, say, we saw this happen. Okay. And then set B comes and say, you couldn't possibly have seen that happen because we were with the victim or we were with the alleged perpetrator. So what you are saying happened couldn't possibly have happened. This is a case of testifying about the event, okay? Testifying about the facts of the case. And in that situation, ein elu zomimin, the first set of witnesses, witnesses A, are not considered to be edim zomimin. Okay? This is then going to be a case of what I referenced before of hachasha, of contradiction. So it's true that now the testimony of witnesses A seems a little shaky because I have witnesses B that say that it's impossible. The result of that might be that the testimony of witnesses A gets thrown out, but nothing negative happens to witnesses A. There is no consequence for witnesses A beyond that they are not successful. Okay, aval, we're in the second part of the Mishnah now. Amru lahem, if they said to them, hey, achatem mi'idin, how could you possibly be testifying? Shehare atem hayitem imanu oto hayom b'makom ploni. You were with us in such and such a place on that day. Then set A, hare elu zomimin, they are killed. V'neharagin al pihem, they are killed on the word of witnesses set B. Okay, so first the Mishnah goes through the scenario that doesn't work, where we both have different versions of the events. And essentially, what the Mishnah says is, I've got witnesses A, witnesses B. One of them says the victim was in Florida, and one of them says the victim was in Hawaii. I don't know which one of these guys is correct. I'm going to reject it all. Essentially, I'm going to say witnesses B were strong enough, right, to undermine the foundation of witnesses A. And I'm not going to believe witnesses A anymore, but witnesses B are not strong enough to have any consequence be applied to witnesses A. Witnesses A are not considered to be edim zomimim for the purposes of being punished for what they tried to accomplish. Okay. However, if the testimony of witnesses B is, you guys are just lying liars that lied because you couldn't possibly have seen something that happened in Hawaii. If you were in Florida, that's not the same place. Okay. In that case, this is very extreme. Okay. And if you're like, hey, I'm not sure this should be the law, you're not alone. But the law is we believe witnesses B over witnesses A. So much so that we punish witnesses A by the testimony of witnesses B, even to the extent of killing the first witnesses. Okay? And this is, in some ways considered to be the like great mystery of Edim Zomimim. Why are we so confident that witnesses B are telling the truth? Right? The first scenario makes much more sense. I've got contradictory evidence. I throw it all out. The second scenario is, oh, the first guys are definitely lying. Let's kill them. And the second ones are believed simply because they came second. Just because you're witnesses B, you are completely believed. Okay? Later, we're going to get into a situation where somebody else comes and either supports witnesses A or contradicts witnesses B. But at this point in this mission, we're going to leave it very simple. The basic principle is I believe witnesses B over witnesses A. If what they are testifying about is the whereabouts of the witnesses, not the whereabouts of the victim or the perpetrator or any other element of the case, the Mishnah chooses to use the case of murder, not just because it is unpleasant, but because it's like if I want to show you the like seriousness, the extent of the law, there's nothing more extreme than this case, right? Where witnesses A are going to be losing their lives. So it's true also about losing their cow. It's true also about losing $10. But when the Mishnah is only going to talk about one case, it's going to make sure to talk about the most extreme case so that you know, oh, well, obviously, if we're going to kill witnesses A, we would also make witnesses A have to pay, some sort of penalty if it's relevant. Okay, the Gemara's first question is, show me the verse. Menahani mile. From where are these words? You just made up this crazy thing, right? Of we're going to believe witnesses B, and the only time that a person is considered to be an eid zomeim is when we testify about the whereabouts of the witnesses. Really? Where are you getting that? So we have a machloket about where it comes from. Amar Rav Ada to Amar Kra. The first opinion is Rav Ada, where he looks at the verse and it says, "V'hinei eid sheker ha'eid sheker ana." Okay, and here we have the word eid, eid, eid. So what you're hearing is witness, 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 and what you're not hearing is edut, 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 testimony, testimony, testimony. And so Rav Ada says that's the Torah's way of telegraphing to you, we are testifying about the witnesses and whether they are plausible witnesses. We're not testifying about the actual facts of the case. That's not what's going on here. Okay, so ad tishaker gufa shel edut, until we can establish that the fact of the testimony, right? It couldn't possibly have happened. You couldn't possibly have been the witnesses. That's the only case where you're considered to be an eid zomeim. Okay, and the school of Rabbi Shmuel finds it from somewhere else. La'anot bo sarah, to testify perversely until the fact of the testimony is perverted. This drasha is, I don't want to say that it's less strong, but it's working differently. The first drasha was looking at the actual words and saying, ha, it says aid, witness, instead of edut, testimony. I'm going to make a lot out of that. And here Rabbi Yishmael is essentially saying the whole phrase of la'anot bo sarah, to testify perversely, is extra. Okay? And whenever I have a phrase in the Torah that is extra, I always think that it's teaching me something. Okay, so essentially Rabbi Shmuel has this tradition that it has to be testimony about the whereabouts of the witnesses. And he also looks at the Torah and is like, wait a minute, this phrase in the Torah is extra. And he makes a match, he makes a shidduch. Okay, so it's less about the actual phrasing of la'anot bo sarah and more about the presence of this phrase that is extra. Okay, so the first question that the Gemara asked, which is a very common question, is, hey, rabbis, you can't just say something without basing it in the Torah. And the first move that the Gemara often does is to bring us back to the verses. You gave me this principle. I'm not arguing with the fact of it, but I need to see it in the verses. Okay, and so we have two ways of reading this into the verses. And now we're going to get to our three Ravas. Okay, if you look, I bolded it for you. Rava said, Rava said, Rava said. Okay, let's try to get through these efficiently. Okay, the first Rava, Amar Rava. If two people came and said, in the eastern quarter of the capital, so and so killed a person. And then two came, witnesses B, and said, but were you not with us in the western quarter of the capital? Okay, so essentially Rava's saying, when witnesses B come and say, Imanu Hayitem, you were with us and you couldn't possibly have seen what you saw, well, how with do they need to be? Okay, like I said, it happened in Manhattan, and you also said it happened in Manhattan, but I said it happened on 86th Street, and you said you were with us on 85th Street. It's true that's not the exact same place, but maybe what I said, the testimony that I had, could still be true. Okay, so the next stage is we examine if from where they were standing in the Western Quarter, it is possible to see the Eastern Quarter, then these are not Edim Zomimim. But if not, they are Edim Zomimim. So essentially, witnesses A said, we were in the East and we saw a crime in the East. Witnesses B said, you were in the West. How could you possibly have seen a crime in the East? Okay. And even though the first witnesses can't prove that they were in the East, if they were able to see a crime in the East, even if they were in the West, we don't consider them to be Edim Zomimim. And then the Gemara says, Pshita, that is obvious. Why do you need to tell me? Well, the claim of Imanu Hayitem, you were with us, has to preclude them from seeing what they saw. Okay, Rava's contribution is when I say you were with me in a different place, that has to be significant. Okay, and it's significant if, because you were in this different place, that means that you couldn't have possibly seen the crime. But if I come and I testify and I say, actually, they were in a different place, but from that different place, they still could have seen the crime, then they're not considered to be conspiring witnesses. We don't have proof that they're maliciously lying. Okay? And then the Gemara says, that is obvious. And then we say, Mahu Tatema, what might you have said? That we should be concerned for exceptionally clear eyesight? Nahora Barya? Kamash Malan, it comes to teach us that we do not. So the Gemara essentially says, you might have thought eastern side of the Capitol, western side of the Capitol. Basically, witnesses B are confirming that they were in the city, right? And how could you possibly say that someone was an Eid Zomim on the basis of that testimony? So what Rava is actually coming to say is, we don't give the witnesses A the benefit of the doubt that they somehow were able to see what an ordinary person couldn't see. We look at the facts on the ground. If a regular person cannot see from the eastern side to the western side, we don't float the possibility that these people are superseers. Okay, one more example. Rava said, if two came and said, in Sura, okay, that's one of the big cities in Babylonia, in the morning of the first day of the week, so-and-so killed a person. And then two people came and said, right, witnesses B came, said, in the evening of the first day of the week, you were with us in Nehardea. Okay, Nehardea is another big city in Babel, and it is far from Sura. Okay, but I think it is not a like 3 days journey. I think it's a complete 1 day's journey. Okay, so it's theoretically possible that I saw something at 6 a.m. in Sura, and then I booked it. And I got to Nehardea by 8 p.m., and then you saw me at Nehardea at 8 p.m. Okay, so if the testimony is, hey, we were in Sura in the morning, and we saw this happen, and then the witnesses B come and they say, how could you have been in Sura on Sunday? You were with us in Nehardea on Sunday. We basically look at it. We examine if from morning to evening one can travel from Sura to Nehardea, they are not conspiring witnesses, but if not, they are conspiring witnesses. Essentially, we say, could the claims of witness A possibly be true? And then the Gemara comes back with the same challenge. This is obvious. But what might you have said? That we should be concerned for Gamla Parcha, a flying camel. It comes to teach us, Kamash Malan, that we're not, right? It's true. Regular traffic conditions from Sura to Nahardaa is going to take 8 hours. But what if you have a flying camel? Okay, then maybe it would be possible for witnesses A to have seen something in Sura and then immediately have landed in Nahardaa a few minutes later. Okay, the Gemara's conclusion is no, right? We're not trying to rely on miracles here. If a regular person driving a regular car, obviously they didn't have cars back then, right, could traverse this distance, then they're not lying. And if a regular person traveling could not traverse that distance, they are lying. And we don't wonder, maybe they had some magical mode of transportation. Maybe they had a helicopter that we don't know about. Okay, that's Rava statement number two. Let's look at Rava statement number three. If two people came and said, on the first day of the week, so and so killed a person, and then two others came, right, witnesses B, and said, but you were with us on the first day of the week. But, on the second day of the week, that so and so did kill a person. Okay, so let's just be clear on the testimony, because it's a little bit confusing. Witnesses A come and say, on Sunday, we saw Bob kill Babina. Then witnesses B come and they say, witnesses A, you totally did not see Bob kill on Sunday because you were with us. But you know what? Bob actually did kill her. He just killed her on Monday. So that's this weird testimony that we're looking at. And not only that, but even if they said, on the eve of Shabbat, so and so killed a person, they are executed. That is, witnesses A. Because at the time that they testified, the man was not yet liable to death. Okay, I'm going to explain this one more time because I know it's a little bit confusing. The first statement of Rava is when people are in two parts of the same city, you need to see, can you see from one place to the other? And you don't worry about the possibility that these people have super duper sight. If they were in a different part of the city and if there's no clear sight lines, they're Eden Dominim. The second scenario is what about travel from one city to another? We see if a standard path of travel would mean that the witnesses could have seen something in Sura in the morning and find themselves in Harda in the evening. If that is possible, great. If it's not possible, they're Eidim Zomabim, even if theoretically somebody could have constructed a time machine that would have teleported them. Okay, and the third Rava is a little bit different, right? Those first two examples are kind of two variations on the same thing. Here, the situation is the people, witnesses A, the facts of the case that they are testifying about are correct in all the important ways. They're right about the victim and they're right about the perpetrator, okay? Because Bob did kill Babina. He is a murderer. He should be put to death. But witnesses B, their testimony was that the murder happened on Monday. But witnesses A testified that the murder happened on Sunday. And so even though it's true that Bob eventually became a murderer, since at the time that they were testifying about Sunday, Bob was still an innocent man, they can be put to death for testifying about his murder. Okay? I'm going to say that one more time because I know it's very complicated and I want to make sure that everybody gets it. I testified about a crime happening on Sunday. That crime did happen, but it happened on Monday. I am still considered to be an Eid Zomeim, and I am still punished as an Eid Zomeim because at the time that I was testifying about Sunday, this person was still innocent. Okay, what does this teach us? We're continuing in the Gemara. My Kamashbalan, what does this teach us? Tanina, we've already learned this, okay? This is in another part of the Mishnah. If one of them is found to be a conspiring witness, he and they are executed, and the second set is exempt. There's a very small snippet of the Mishnah, but essentially this Mishnah describes the exact case that Rava was talking about. Okay? And that in that scenario, he, that is Bob, the killer, and they, the people who testified about Bob killing, but testified about it happening at the wrong time, they're all killed. Okay, Bob is killed for being a killer, and witnesses A are killed for testifying against Bob falsely, even though eventually turned out they were right and he was a killer. Okay, and then we say, Tanina, but we already had this. We had this case in the Mishnah, and the Mishnah said, Hu vehein neharagin, Bob and the first witnesses are killed. So I already know this. Rava, why are you coming to teach me something that is explicit in the Mishnah? Okay. And then we say the latter clause is necessary. This is not so with regard to the completion of judgment. Okay, that what Rava said, okay, is not true when we're talking about testifying about the outcome of a case. Okay, if two came and said on the first day of the week, the outcome of so-and-so was completed, okay, their court case was finished, and then two came and said on the first day of the week, you were with us, but on the eve of Shabbat, the judgment of so-and-so was completed. And not only that, but even if they said on the second day of the week, the judgment of so-and-so is completed, they are not executed because at the time they testified, the man was liable for death. And similarly, with regard to the payment of a fine, let's ignore that. That's just saying, even though we're talking about death and murder, it's also the same for money. So let's go back. Okay, this case is very complicated, but I have faith in you and I have faith in us. It is not only the case that I can testify about what I saw happen live, right? I can testify about seeing Bob kill Babina. That is the like default normal kind of testimony. But it's also possible for me to testify not about what Bob did, but about the outcome of a court case, okay? This becomes especially relevant if Bob flees the court. Okay, and he's in some other jurisdiction, and we need to know whether he's liable. So I could have witnesses that testify not about whether Bob killed, but whether or not Bob was found guilty. Okay, Nigmar Dino Shel Ploni is this is when this person was found guilty. Okay, so let's go back in and let's look at this again. When you do it the second time, it's always much clearer. If two came and said, on Sunday, the judgment of so-and-so was completed, this person is considered to be a dead man walking from Sunday, right? They were condemned to death on Sunday. And then two came and said, you were with us on Sunday. You couldn't possibly have been a court observer on Sunday. You were with us at the baseball game. But they also say, but you know what? The content of what you said was right. Bob was found guilty, and he was found guilty Friday. Okay? He was found guilty earlier than what you testified about. Okay? Not only that, but even if they said on the second day of the week, the judgment of so-and-so was completed, even if the testimony of witnesses B is, you are right about what you said, but it didn't happen on Friday. It happened on Monday, okay? These are not executed. Witnesses A are not executed because at the time that they testified, the man was liable for death. Okay, so essentially what we have from this third Rava is kind of two mirror principles. If I testified about someone that they were guilty of murder, but they didn't become guilty of murder until later, then I'm a liar and I was trying to get them killed. And it doesn't matter that after the fact I turned out to be right. I'm put to death and they're put to death. They're put to death for being a murderer and I'm being put to death for being a liar because I testified about Sunday and they killed on Monday. Off with my head, okay? That's the case number one. But the inverse is, what if I'm not testifying about what actually happened, the live event, but I'm testifying about the judgment. And I'm saying this person was found liable for murder and therefore liable for the death penalty on this day of the week or that day of the week or that day of the week. Okay, as long as at the time that I am testifying, that person was already condemned to death, then I am not considered to be an aid zomein. Okay, because this is going to shock you all, you cannot kill someone who is already dead. Okay. And if that person was found guilty in a court of law and they were sentenced to death, I can't then re-sentence them to death. Right. So essentially, kasher zamam la'asot, the thing that I planned to do was re-kill a dead man. Okay. And that's not nice. And that's not good. And that's not healthy testimony. But that is not something that is going to then inflict the death penalty upon me. Okay. So the lines here and the details here are very specific. Okay, we have 1 minute. I see your hand off now, but I don't think we have time for your question. Just going to summarize as quickly as I can everything that we saw. The Torah talked about a lying witness, an eid chamas, all this different terminology, and an eid zomim. The Rambam says, really, the only kind of lying witness that ever gets any penalty is the person who is considered to be a conspiring witness, an eid zomim. Okay, anybody else who it looks like they might be lying, we actually characterize them as mistaken, okay, and we don't actually serve them any penalty. Now, how does one become an eid zomim? It cannot be that witnesses B testify to there's something off with the facts that I'm testifying about. Then they're just contradicting the content of my testimony. Witnesses B are only powerful if they come and they say, witnesses A could not have seen what they saw. Okay? You have to be testifying about the possibility of them being witnesses, not about the content of their testimony. Okay? Then we went into the Gemara. The first thing the Gemara did was park this in the Torah. Very nice. We always need to do that. And then we had these three statements of Rava. The first two statements of Rava were essentially just saying, you actually need to investigate, right? Whether what witnesses B said actually does invalidate the possibility of the testimony of witnesses A. They're in the same city, but they're in different places. They're in two different cities, but they're not that far away. You need to actually do your due diligence to find out if it is it possible for these people to be telling the truth. But that due diligence only goes so far. You have to see if it's possible for a regular car to get from Sura to Nehar Da'a. You don't need to check for a flying car, okay? And then the last thing that we saw is that an eid zomim cannot testify about somebody who is already dead. Okay? If the person I'm testifying about has already been found guilty, then I may be a liar and I may be a lowlife, but I don't get put to death for killing someone who has already been sentenced to death. But if I testify about someone that they killed on Sunday, and in fact, they only killed on Monday, even though that guy's a murderer. And it turned out that I was right about him, okay? Because at the time that I'm testifying, he is still an innocent man. I'm trying to kill him a day early, right? I'm lying about him, and I still get put to death for testifying about a murderer that they murdered, okay? It's very important. It's very extreme. This guy was a murderer. But he wasn't a murderer the way that I said he was. So he gets put to death for being a murderer, and I get put to death for trying to kill him, even though it turns out if I had waited a day, I would have been right. Okay, the moral of the story is to always wait a day because then maybe you'll be right. We are going to close here, and I'm looking forward to exploring all the other intricacies of the Eid Zomim next week.